Session number 16718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 14.
Mr. White, Reel 14. We last spoke, Mr. White, when you were moving through Tunisia, already a prisoner of war, by train. What happened to you after that?
We eventually, within a week of being captured in time scale, we eventually arrived in Tunis, and we were marched. A group of prisoners, 40, 50 hours perhaps, to what had been a large garage. It was empty of anything, concrete floor, and four walls and a roof. It was divided into two. The rear part was where we bedded down for the night, and the other part was where we could walk about. We were, of course, under lock and key, and guards were at the doors. I can't remember anything about the facilities. The food was a bit iffy. We got something daily, yes, but there was no regular. It was blatantly an obvious temporary holding enclosure. One of the interesting things that I do remember was a guards officer who had been taken at the Marath line round about the same time, came in a day after we had arrived and sort of dropped his bit of kit that he had with him alongside my bit of kit. And it was liberal, oh dear, fancy forgetting his name. Mark Bonham Carter, who did, you know, great service later on in politics, and he made me laugh. He said, having introduced ourselves, he said, "Now we must pool our resources and share them out." And that's the way we've got to go now, you know, support each other. And I said, "Well, that sounds all very well. What resources do you have?" And he says, "Well, what resources do you have?" And I said, "Well, I've got," and I fiddled around, and I had a bag which I used to carry along with me, strapped onto my webbing. And in it was a bar of chocolate. Now, I think it was the iron ration, really. He says, "You're lucky to have that." Well, that goes in the pot. And I had something else. I can't remember what it was now, whether it was a box of cigarettes or matches or something. I said, "What have you got?" And he had a tin of Brasso, you know, and some dubbins for his boots. That was his contribution. So I vowed I would never vote Liberal again. But we were there only a few days.
Were you all officers at this time?
Yes.
Other ranks had been moved on.
We were separated from the... Wait a minute now. Huh? Well, we were separated, if you know what I mean. But I think there was other ranks about. Well,
we're sleeping on the floor.
Sleeping on the on the concrete floor, no bedding, no or blankets that I remember. And yes, Ian was there with me. We saw and chatted over, and obviously had to look out for. See if there's an obvious way of getting out, that we weren't missing anything, that we, you know, what sort of effort was required. But it all looked pretty blank and bleak.
Were the guards Italians or Germans?
Oh, Italians. We'd been sort of captured on their territory, and they made the most of things. We were theirs, not the Germans.
Were they treating you all right at this stage?
Oh, at this stage, no complaints other than the very obvious ones, you know, the agony of being a prisoner, and...
Were you concerned about what your parents might ultimately hear or not?
Well,
hear?
The answer to that is very definitely yes. But again, you know, you can do nothing about that that sort of thing. And I don't suppose we were there for much more than a week. When we were marched down to the harbour and put aboard a ship, a smallish ship, and crammed in there. I met a young officer who had just, you know, sort of 3 days before or 4 days before had been in London. And of course, he'd come over with the First Army. And got straight into the bag, you know, some ambush or whatever. And he sort of brought us up to date with the stuff we wanted to hear. Then off we went in some sort of convoy, but the Italians were very, very jumpy about the whole thing. And indeed, I've memories of... seeing most of the soldiers anyway, whether they were crew or not, marching about with their boots tied round their neck, you know, to facilitate their swimming, I suppose. And the trip was sheer misery because there's only limited toilet facilities. And no sooner had you been there than you had to get in the queue for the next call of nature, which, as always happens, you know, you need to go a lot when there's nowhere to go, as it were.
Was your health suffering?
Marginally. I had a bit of jippy tummy, we used to call it. I seemed to... Well, we weren't sort of eating regularly, you know, and it was one of these things you just had to, you had to bear. It was, other than a discomfort, it was no, there was no real illness.
You'd be obviously fastened down in the bowels of the boat, were you?
Yes, but as I said, there was this queue leading sort of round the hold and up the ladder that... to the loos, and you know, after a bit I suppose you settle down to some sort of regularity, but that is a blinding thought that remains of that journey. There was talk of taking over the ship. Well, could we do anything? There were a lot of us, and but we didn't make much headway with that. You know, there's all sorts of wild ideas enter your head immediately in amongst the fresh air and outside the camp or wherever you're being held. If I could only do this, maybe I could do that, and you know, you get agitated a bit. But we eventually landed in the Naples area and were taken off to another temporary camp, a place called, I think, Capua. And this was the classic prisoner of war camp as depicted on the, you know, on the box in the cinemas, the wooden huts raised slightly from the ground, barbed wire everywhere, and the guards going around, and the towers, and the guns, just as, you know, just as, well, as just what one expected. And there it had all the things that you expect to find from on our side, the committees who are always preparing escapes and sewing cloths and forging documents. There was this side of the camp. There was the bunk beds.
Were the crowded facilities?
The facilities were pretty crowded. It was an officers only camp, this. And
did it have a number or name? Or?
Well, not that I remember. It would have, though. It would have. It could be clearly... I might be able to find that for you for another time. Somewhere, I was looking for the document before you came. There's a document which lists in a form every prisoner of war camp.
You were sleeping on bunks, you said.
Yes.
How many would there be to a hut?
Of the sort of order of 30-ish.
Was that crowded?
Yes, well, you didn't have much space. There was a really famous sort of barrel fire with a chimney for warmth, and there was the Italian guard who was snooping around all the time. You had to watch out for. And meals were a regular issue of a piece of bread, and there's a hot meal in the sort of midday afternoon time, or sometimes it was put back to the evening depending on what was going on, and sort of, I don't know what best description is, as a gruel sort of thing. And they had got some Red Cross parcels, and I believe while we were there we had one or two.
What would they contain?
Well, surprisingly, a lot of butter, a jar of jam, a bar of chocolate, a tin of meat or bacon, sort of the cooked bacon that had gone cold, as it were. That it was great stuff, if you could. A lot of sugar, you know, a big bag of sugar. Perhaps a tin of fish, you know, pilchards or sardines, that sort of thing. They had some large biscuits, which were they were good value. They, of course, they used to fill you up a bit, you know. But a bar of chocolate, perhaps. And perhaps some cigarettes, you know, like a packet of 10 or a tin of 50 sometimes, you know. And as you can readily imagine, when you're living on the minimum, they were sort of, you know, God's gift, really. Came via Red Cross. I can remember getting a lot of Canadian parcels to start with. But we had French prisoners of war as well. And we had there was certain things they liked the tins of fish, and we bartered the tins of fish for, well, in my case, cigarettes, because at that time I was an avid smoker. And I was suffering withdrawal symptoms, you know, every minute. And Ian used to get most of my chocolate. I gave him my chocolate for his cigarette ration or similar. And you know, when we got them, which was once every 3 or 4 weeks, a Red Cross parcel was a thing to have.
Were you getting your entitlement? The Italians weren't keeping any back at all, were they?
I've no way of knowing, because it was so easy for them to say that the parcels haven't arrived. You sank the ship that was bringing the parcels from Italy, or you shot down the plane. I found great difficulty in knowing what was regular. It wasn't a case of Thursday's Red Cross parcel day, you know. It was just something that sort of an issue when we thought we were probably getting restless or something.
The accommodation, if we can just talk a little bit longer about it. Mm. You say there was 30-ish in the room, mm-hmm. With a stove for heating purposes. Latrines and toilets, what were they like?
Basic. But there's a washing facility, you know, the bowl basin sort of thing. There was no hot showers or anything like that. If you're on a working party, you'd get a regular bath, but then officers didn't do that sort of work, did they? The convention.
Was it cold water? You didn't have any hot water at all?
I remember only cold water. Yes. And of course...
Was there a medical centre in the camp?
I suppose the answer is yes, but Who
ran the camp from the prisoner of war point of view, you know, of your own discipline?
Mm-hmm. There was a committee, really, a senior officer who was the lord of all he surveyed. And you were responsible through the senior officer in the hut who was responsible to him. You were controlled in that sort of fashion. It was, within limits, it was very free and easy, the control. Although you were kept informed by the various means we had at our disposal, there was wireless there, but undercover, sort of.
This is your own hidden wireless.
That's right, yes.
And had that been, had that been made out of bits and pieces, or was it a proper radio?
Well, one seldom got to know, but there's always a strong black market, you know, attached to camps, because the Italians were all susceptible to a bit of bribery. I mean, remember, they'd had nothing for many years in the way of chocolates and sweets and English or American cigarettes, you know, the sort of people that were contacting us. And when you get a strong, fit, healthy RAF bloke who had to jump out, but he'd been dining, I don't know, probably running the black market in a corner of England before he'd done it. It was very quickly the sort of entrepreneur sort of person took a grip, and he would find a value for 500 cigarettes would get him a sack of potatoes or a turkey or a part of a wireless set, perhaps. And along those sort of lines, by bartering, trade, pinching, what these things happened. You suddenly find you could have a wireless that picked up a program in English from, you know, wherever.
And it had to be well hidden from the
guard. Oh, yes, because they were after things like that all the time. All the time.
We're talking about the discipline, as I say, through your senior officer, and through, you say, to the huts themselves with the senior officer. Did it cause any problems there?
None whatsoever. There's a very, on the face of it, a very easygoing discipline, you know, but there was a quite strict army discipline at the basis of it. I mean, you accepted that he who was number one was number one, and you did what you told.
Did the French have their own system?
Yes. They were sort of, you had this segregation. But we mixed, as I say, when we swapped our goodies. We had a bit of bartering there. I can't remember the cookhouse was an open air affair, but there were elected people acting as cooks, you know, our men, making the stew under supervision of the Italians, of course. But then we sort of took our turns in dishing it out. It's a marvelous way of sharing everything out equally, because when you know that your turn's going to come when you have the soup ladle and can look after yourself and your friends.
Did you eat, when you were given your food, did you go back to your hut and eat it, or was it a dining place?
Yes, no, I don't remember the dining place. We probably just squatted around on the hope of seconds, or thirds, or fourths. We didn't go far until it was time to fall out. It was obviously, again, a temporary camp, and the Italians were, the soldiers were mad keen that you behaved yourselves. And
did they show any brutality at any time?
Well, there were instances of one or two people being beaten up, but of course, I was I can't remember seeing the brutal act happening. Or the cause of it, because everybody took the Mickey out of the Italians at the least provocation, you know. And sometimes some people went over the top, undoubtedly, and they probably got a thump. But
were there favorite occupations or events that you particularly chose to make life difficult for the Italians?
Well,
thinking in terms of counting, for example, at roll call.
No, I haven't any funny stories to tell about that, but it would happen. But I remember a bit later on, we got some musical instruments, you know, from the Red Cross. Well, giving a prisoner of war a trumpet, or cornet, or whatever you call it, you pick up the bugle calls of the Italian army very quickly, you know. And that used to cause a bit of a laugh. And turned out the guard, you know, got them all fell in. And then, of course, you lean out and laugh at them. And they sort of fire back with the machine guns, you know, just spray you around just to liven the day up. When it was, I think, when I was in this temporary camp, I made a pudding, you know. I saved up the crust of my bun for a few days, and I had one of the tin cans I'd saved. We knocked some holes in it and made it a form of grater. And I grated this all a mess, really, into a pile of crumbs. And I had all this butter. And would you believe a bag of sultanas? You know, the most incredible things. And sugar, of course. And I don't doubt there's such a thing as milk substitute, the powdered milk, you know. And made it into a buttery paste, really. And packed it in another well-greased tin. Rigged up a steamer arrangement. And had me pile of wood and got the fire going. And one of the guards' officers, Philip Kindersley, who later was, I think, Minister of the Post Office or something when he got into Civ Street, Lord Philip Kindersley, he sat down and watched me do this. And at the end of it, he said, well, that is, not only does it smell delicious, but I was most impressed the way you produced that, because this was the stage where I'd got it out of the thing and had it hanging on the tin plate, my pudding stood wobbling there, and of course, sucker me, would you care to join me for lunch? That sort of thing. He says, I certainly wouldn't. Do you mind if I bring my friend? He was a headmaster at Winchester School or somewhere. He was also a guardsman. And I thought, not very bright, why it took you a long time to get that pudding. It was all right then. But I made a pudding. Because you'd mentioned it before about what to do with tin cans. That one of the SAS captured on some raid, he was making an oven out of the tin cans. He had a lot of cans which he sort of cut and opened and beaten. And he had it with the oven door on it, and a place for the wood for the fire, and the shelves inside, and it was a marvelous little thing. I never saw it in working, but it looked impressive. All out of tin cans. I've no recollection of anybody making an attempt to escape. But we all knew that there was an escape committee, and that you had to accept that if you had the idea for an escape, you had to present it to them, sell it to this committee, and thereafter they helped you away. But it had to go through the committee, as it were. And, quite rightly so. And We weren't there much more than a month. When we were, moved, the word came round that we were going to move. And we were entrained and went by train via Rome up to the permanent camp, PG 49 at Fontanalata.